The political world is becoming increasingly volatile and unpredictable, while at the same time having a profound impact on the lives of citizens across the globe. This is Polis Podcast, and I am Thomas Barton, the founder of Polis Analysis. Every week, I'll be in the virtual armchair with relevant experts from Polis teams to discuss the key developments shaping the political world. All we need is for you to join us on the virtual sofa.
The Middle East is a region which is often known for its political volatility and uncertainty. And not only can developments in the region have an impact for its citizens living there, but it can really have global ramifications too. There have been some new political actors that have emerged on the scene in the Middle East. And so today, for the third episode of Polis Podcast, I'll be joined by the Polis Analysis lead editor, Adam, who has a background in the Middle East from an academic and professional standpoint. And he'll be taking us through what's been happening in relation to the new leaders that have emerged on the political scene. So Adam, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to episode 3. And yeah, the first question I've got for you is, we've seen two new leaders emerge in the Middle East, notably the new Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, and also the new Iranian President, Ibrahim Raisi. So can you just tell our listeners a little bit more about who these two new figures are?
Yeah, happy to. Well, thank you so much for having me today. I'm really excited to be joining the podcast at such a critical time for the Middle East, really a pivotal time for the region. Well, starting with the new Israeli Prime Minister. So the country really had been led by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for over 12 years, 15 in total, if we include his time in the 90s. This former politician had, or former Prime Minister had been marred in several alleged cases of fraud and corruption, all of which he has continuously vehemently denied. The country in turn held four indecisive elections for the past few years, which has led to governments that could not come up with a budget, couldn't really extend policies beyond emergency care. And obviously you can imagine during a pandemic that was not what Israel needed. So there's definitely a sigh of relief now that there is a coalition government of 61 seats out of 120, led by Naftali Bennett, who, for some context on Bennett, he's a right-wing leader of the Yamina party, Yamina actually standing for right or right wing, and he's really considered a former political protege of Netanyahu while Netanyahu was prime minister. So a bit more context about how the coalition was formed. A deal was struck with Yair Lapid, who's been a longtime opposition leader in parliament for over a decade. And Lapid will become prime minister in 2 years and is currently serving as foreign minister.
Sure. And yeah, that's really helpful, Adam. And I think it's important to note as well, this is a truly historic government that's been formed with Naftali Bennett at its helm, given there are 8 parties involved in the coalition, which is absolutely huge. And for the first time, there's been the inclusion of the Arab List parties as well, which is quite a historic moment. Just for the benefit of our listeners, can you also tell us a bit about the new Iranian president and how did Raisi reach this new position, and how did he come to become the new president of Iran?
Yeah, absolutely. So former President Rouhani, or he's still sitting in office, but he'll be leaving in a month, could not run for re-election because he had just finished his maximum second term. It really had long been speculated that Ibrahim Raisi, who's a member of the judiciary with close connections to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, would be selected to run as Rouhani's successor. This was basically secured by the Guardian Council, which is a 12-member body overseeing national elections and policies and politics as a whole. They artificially brought down the number of eligible candidates from several hundred to a few dozen, which greatly facilitated a Raisi victory. In terms of Raisi's background and general politics and world outlook positioning, he's been known for his definitely conservative outlook and court rulings, as well as his longtime commitment to exporting Iran's revolution, which we'll get to in a bit later. So really, from what I've seen and by most accounts, if not all, He will likely follow the path of his predecessors with regard to Iran's regional policies. And these range from funding proxy groups in Yemen, Lebanon, Syria, and so forth, and growing anti-Sunni rhetoric.
Sure. And I think that's, it's really important that you've touched on what we can expect next in terms of Iranian policy. And we'll come to that a bit later on in our discussion. But if we stick with Israel for the moment, Adam, what does this new government led by Naftali Bennett concretely mean for Israeli citizens? Like, can they actually expect any change domestically? What are some of the key sort of legislative initiatives we can expect to be delivered by this new government?
Yeah, well, so I'm happy you mentioned the inclusion of the Ram Party, the quote-unquote Islamist party, because it is a first in Israeli history. There, for context, Israel is made up of 20% Arab Israelis with full voting power and full representation in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. However, this is the first time that a Arab Israeli party is included in a ruling coalition. So it does present a double-edged sword for Mansour Abbas, who's the leader of the Ram Party, because on one hand, he's definitely walking a fine line of working with the majority right-wing coalition to secure some gains for Arab-Israeli citizens while still catering to the pro-Palestinian base in Israel proper. And then also he has to be mindful of citizens in the West Bank and even potentially in Gaza, just because of their perception of his working with the right-wing coalition. But so in terms of concrete domestic proposals and potential changes, I think the Ram Party led by Abbas, as I just said, will be regarding funding for education, I think, in Arab Israeli districts and schools, and then probably infrastructure, if I had to make an assertion. That's kind of the impression I'm getting. And those are the two policies that the Ram Party have been promoting for a while. So now that they actually have a say in a ruling coalition and are not just a member of the opposition parties, I think they'll finally get some compromise with the ruling coalition in that respect.
Okay, that's fascinating then. So this new government could potentially lead to some material change and benefits for Arab Israeli citizens. And I wonder as well, we'll have to wait and see whether the inclusion of left wing parties in this coalition, which we haven't seen for a while, given Netanyahu was the former prime minister. So it'll be interesting to see whether that will actually lead to any changes in sort of welfare policy and, you know, broader sort of economic outlooks and approach by the Israeli government. But just turning to the sort of international dimension of Israel, what does this new government actually mean for Israeli policy in the region and foreign policy? Because I mean, there are two schools of thought out there. Adam, I wonder, based on your expertise, if you can break them down. Because on the one hand, the new Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, as you said, was a former protege of Netanyahu. He ended up, turning against him. But he's actually more right-wing than the former Prime Minister. I've read some accounts suggesting that he actually supports further expansion in terms of settlements. And, that he believes in expansion of up to 60% in the West Bank area, for instance. So on the one hand, can we expect this new prime minister to have an even more nationalistic right-wing flavor to the Israeli government's foreign policy? Or is it the case that given, as you mentioned earlier, Bennett has a majority of one and is leading a coalition of eight parties from the left all the way to the center, with Yesh Atid holding a lot of sway as a sort of centrist, pragmatic party, all the way through to the right? Is it actually the case that he won't be able to sort of deliver on his more right-wing instincts when it comes to Israeli foreign policy?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. It is a coalition leading by one, and Bennett has all the incentive to keep the coalition going. So if he really does go with his right-wing instincts, all it takes is for, and this is back to the Ram Party, the quote-unquote Islamist party, to withdraw from the coalition, which will lead to new elections. So Bennett really has to be careful with how he treads the line of catering to his predominantly right-wing base while still maintaining the coalition in place. I suspect that if the coalition is to crumble, it would come from either Yesh Atid with Lapid, or you're right, the Islamist party. But with regard to Israeli foreign policy broadly, I think we'll see more continuity than change. I think back to what I was saying earlier, there will probably be some change. There will probably be some change with regard to domestic politics with the Arab-Israeli community. But with foreign policy, it seems that there's going to be more of the same in a sense, which could be counterintuitive given how politically diverse the coalition is. And you're definitely right about that, 8 parties, largely unprecedented. But one example I want to highlight is the fact that Foreign Minister Lapid, as I mentioned, he's serving for 2 years as foreign minister, just completed an official trip to the United Arab Emirates, where he met with the Emirati Minister of Foreign Affairs. So the meeting symbolized the emerging Israeli-Emirati relationship, which was officially launched during the Trump administration and has been referred to as the Abraham Accords. By all accounts, both the Biden administration and a strong majority of Israeli politicians support the recent normalization, as do leaders in the UAE. So I suspect that will continue. And that's really a seminal moment in Israeli foreign policy, regional policy, this deeper integration into the region beyond simply Jordan and Egypt. Now there's the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. So Israel has a lot of commercial and political incentives to keep those going, and actually security as well with regard to Iran. So I think that will be maintained, and that is not an issue over which I think the Ram party or a left-wing party as part in the coalition would break away from this agreement. The accords would continue into the Biden administration and really perpetuate for as long as it can, given the really strong incentives for Israel. And then more beyond simply Sunni states, I think more internationally, Israel still strongly opposes Iran's potential nuclear program and has enlisted Biden's support during President Rivlin's recent visit to Washington. The president, it has more of a symbolic role, but him still traveling to DC indicates some degree of commitment to the Biden administration and the first official visit of an Israeli leader. So in that respect, Israeli foreign policy is not set to change, still categorically opposed to Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon because of the fear that it could actually be turned on Israel. And when one hears the rhetoric emerging from Iranian leaders to many in Israel, that fear is well-founded. And then finally, outside of the Middle East, from what I've seen, Israel's new government does not appear to have new plans vis-a-vis Europe. However, and this is, I think, important, the new coalition is trying to draw a line with former Prime Minister Netanyahu with regard to the Biden administration. And this, the fact that Biden is president is all the more important because of his former role as vice president during the Obama administration. And by all accounts, that was a toxic relationship between Netanyahu and Obama for really 2008 to 2009 to 2016. In 2015, Netanyahu did took a trip to speak to Congress without really notifying the Obama administration about the Iran nuclear deal, condemning it in the United States, and it was quite embarrassing for the Obama administration. So the new coalition has an incentive to draw a distinction between themselves and the former prime minister and reset the tone with regard to the Biden administration.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think it's important that we remember that actually, as you say, Biden was a key figure in the Obama administrations, and maybe he's got a long memory in terms of how Netanyahu and the Obama sort of played out their relationship. So, but it sounds like out of it's continuity over change when it comes to Israeli foreign policy. That's what we can expect, and I think without reading too much into this, the new Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, actually accepts that himself. And that's probably in recognition of the sort of fragile nature of his 8-party coalition with a majority of one, because he himself was quoted recently saying, "Nobody will have to give up their ideology, but all will have to postpone the realization of some of their dreams." And he said that in relation to the new agreement that was struck between the eight parties that have formed the new Israeli government. So I think even the prime minister is aware that actually there won't really necessarily be much room for delivering on change because of the nature of the coalition. But you mentioned the importance of Iran and the sort of security concerns that plays into vis-a-vis Israeli foreign policy. So let's now pivot back to Iran, Adam, if we may. So we've got this new Iranian president, and you know, the question I want to put to you is he new in name only? Can we expect any change for Iranians domestically? And can we expect any change in Iranian foreign policy? Because again, I mean, if we can start with the foreign policy dimension to this, you know, there seem to be competing ideas when it comes to what Raisi, the new Iranian president, will do on the nuclear deal and the negotiations with the United States. So because on the one hand, Raisi seems to be quite a conservative, right-wing politician, that may, you know, mean that he is not as willing to compromise and negotiate with the United States. And you even mentioned earlier, Adam, that he, when asked at a press conference after his election victory, as to whether he would want to meet President Biden, he firmly said no. So that's just on the one hand that maybe the nuclear deal with Iran is in danger, and actually the U.S. Government under Biden may want to actually find an agreement before the inauguration of the new president on the 8th of August. But then at the same time, there are other analysts suggesting that actually Raisi has a vested interest in ensuring that a deal is struck because of the sort of economic benefits that would come from the lifting of American sanctions on the Iranian economy. We know that Iran has struggled massively with the COVID-19 outbreak, and I believe that around 83,000 Iranians have died from the virus. So economically, the country is therefore struggling. So which of these competing claims is right, Adam? And what can our listeners expect to see in terms of any change, or indeed continuity for that matter, when it comes to Iranian, you know, foreign policy and domestic too?
Yeah, it definitely, Raisi's is an interesting situation because on one hand, he can't appear too eager to enter in a new negotiation with the United States, whether a rebranded JCPOA or a more comprehensive one. The Biden administration sure hopes to have a new deal be more comprehensive than the one that was struck under the Obama administration. The JCPOA from the Obama administration really only carried weight with regard to Iran's potential nuclear program, whereas the Biden administration has indicated concern about Iran's funding of proxy groups and its international ballistic missile program. So Raisi is going to want to secure the economic relief with the lifting of the sanctions without caving too much beyond its nuclear program. Because we do have to remember that he is, by all accounts, more of a hardliner than Rouhani and former foreign minister Zarif were, who were much more amenable when they rose to power in the mid-2000s. So I suspect that. And then the final factor to consider is Raisi wants to secure legitimacy, to actually have a mandate that the Iranian citizens can get behind, because it was an obscure process, the one that led him to power. As I mentioned, the Guardian Council brought down the number of candidates. He had long had the support of the Supreme Leader, but you got to wonder how much support he actually has from the Iranian population. So securing the deal without caving on the ballistic missile program or funding for Hezbollah, Hamas, and so forth would grant him that mandate to continue on into his term. And it would, if it were secured before his inauguration, it would spell a very good omen for him and his administration. So,
sure. Okay. So, That's interesting, Adam. And I'm wondering, Therefore, we've talked about the new Israeli government. We've talked about the new Iranian presidency. And what can we expect moving forward when it comes to relations between these two states? Will these new leaders in their respective countries actually change relations moving forward, or can we expect tensions between Israel and Iran to remain incredibly high? I mean, based on what the new foreign minister Lapid has said recently, I would argue that it seems as though relations will remain extremely difficult. He mentioned that the butcher of Tehran, which is a term used to describe the new president Raisi, is committed to a campaign of global terror. And Lapid made those comments in relation to Iranian support for terrorist organizations and other groups in the region to sort of, you could argue, create instability in the region. So is it fair to say that actually this new conservative Iranian president will continue to take a hardline approach to Israel, which may in turn lead to the Israeli coalition government also taking a hard line? Or does the inclusion of left-wing parties and an Arab party in the Israeli government mean that we could see a softening in the Israeli position? What can we actually expect to unfold in terms of the Israeli-Iranian relationship going forward?
From what I understand, Iran is definitely a bipartisan issue, if we'll call it that, or a more consensus-based issue in Israel. Nearly everyone thinks Israel is Iran is an enemy with the intention to severely harm Israel. So I haven't heard of any politicians in Israel not engaging in some level of rhetoric against Iran. So in that respect, the coalition party will need to take a hard line. And back to the Vienna discussions, under the Obama administration, as I mentioned, Israel took a very strong opposition stance against it. And if the Vienna talks were to conclude with an agreement, I suspect that if it doesn't include the international ballistic program and funding of proxy groups, Israel will still take a hard line. So in that respect, I don't think relations are going to get better. And actually, if to my point about Israeli foreign policy with regard to the U.S., if the U.S. endorses this plan, that actually could hurt Israel's relationship with the Biden administration.
Sure. Okay. That's very interesting to note. We can't necessarily expect a change in that sense. I suppose one final point that we should touch on, and this has been a running theme throughout our conversation, Adam, is what we can expect in terms of the durability of the Israeli coalition government. And we'll come to the new Raisi presidency in a moment, but just quickly on the new Israel coalition, as we mentioned throughout this conversation, it's fragile. They've got a majority of one seat in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. It's comprised of eight political parties from across the political spectrum with very competing views and ideals and policy platforms. So actually, can we expect this coalition government to last? The sense that I get and that many analysts get is that this government was formed not out of ideological congruence, not out of sort of, you know, a shared set of ideals, but it was more created because of this one idea, this one binding idea that brought all these parties together, which is they wanted to get rid of Netanyahu. And is that enough for a reason for government to sort of survive and thrive in the longer term?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. They do call themselves the Change Coalition, not necessarily the Progressive Coalition, the Conservative Coalition, specifically the Change Coalition, which is, I think, purposefully neutral and does not indicate in which political direction they want to take other than removing Netanyahu. So you're definitely right about that. And I think the majority of analysts got that right. But with regard to durability, I think one pressure point will be annexation of the West Bank. I could definitely foresee the Islamist Party under Mansour Abbas defecting from the coalition if Bennett were to go forth with annexation. But the other aspect to consider is the fact that under the Abraham Accords, normalization was achieved by the Israeli government promising not to go forth with annexation of portions of the West Bank. So Bennett, while he in his heart of hearts may want to see the West Bank annexed, or again, portions of the West Bank annexed, he has to worry about, one, what it could mean with regard to the Abraham Accords, and two, what it could mean for the fragile coalition. And then the final aspect, and this is that we keep forgetting the elephant in the room, former Prime Minister Netanyahu has extreme vested interest in breaking up the coalition, and he will do everything in his power to put pressure points on specific members, like both individual elected members, on parties, on upcoming votes, votes of legislation. He is not only is he in a fight for political survival, but because he is no longer prime minister, could very well face a definitive trial with the alleged corruption charges. So if he's able to bring a hasty end to the coalition and trigger a new round of elections, it would not be a stretch for him to be reelected and then secure some longer political survival and potentially legal safety or security, if you will. So there are a lot of factors making the coalition survival very, very challenging.
That's a really good point, Adam. Actually, we keep thinking about how there are a lot of divisions internally in the new government, which could lead to a fracturing of the coalition. But there are equally external pressures too, as you say, coming from Netanyahu's desire to break up this coalition because of the vested political interest he has in doing so, the ones you just articulated. So it sounds like the Israeli coalition is fragile, and the new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, has to, he has a very careful balancing act that he has to really sort of he has to be incredibly delicate in how he sort of conducts himself and trying to keep together all the different factions of his government. But in contrast, is it fair to say that actually the new president in Iran, Raisi, has actually cemented himself and has a really sort of strong power base in Iran? Because it looks like he's won 72% of the vote. Yes, turnout was below 50%, and you also mentioned earlier that the Guardian Council banned a lot of candidates. 12 reformist candidates were banned from standing in the election. So is this a sign that actually the new president Raisi has really got a strong power base in Iranian politics, and can we expect him to be around for quite some time on the political scene?
I think he'll stick around, but at strong cost. It is significantly harder to remove an Iranian president than it is an Israeli prime minister or an elected member in Europe or North America or in other G7 or G20 countries. For the following reason, there are already emerging protests in the originating from workers in the energy sector. In the past few weeks, I think they're only set to grow, and it could lead to larger protests. It could lead to deaths. It could lead to crackdowns. It could lead to reports of human rights abuses. So that Raisi, or President-elect Raisi, on one hand, can secure legitimacy by bringing economic relief with the nuclear accords, if we'll call them that, if they're going to be only nuclear accords or more comprehensive. But he can secure economic relief on that, but he also can hurt his image if, as soon as he's inaugurated on August 8th and the protests are still going, if he orders a crackdown, that will likely hurt his image as well. And particularly so because the as I mentioned, the protests are originating in the energy sector, which is long believed to be Iran's most critical sector. The workers are first among equals in the eyes of the Iranian leadership. They're often praised for their devotion, for their patriotism, for serving in such a critical sector of the economy. So ordering a brutal suppression of workers in that sector, I think, would only harm his image even more. So he once again, he will likely stay in power because I can't envision a scenario other than a revolution in which he would be ousted from power. But the mandate he can secure and profit from will be diminished if he orders a crackdown, or if the Vienna talks do not prove fruitful by his inauguration date or even post inauguration date.
That's an interesting point, Adam. So, I mean, the deputy director of Chatham House, which is a world-renowned think tank that focuses on international affairs, has dubbed the outcome of the Iranian presidential election a conservative consolidation not seen since 2005. So, you know, on the one hand, you could argue that actually it's clear that the incoming president, Raisi, has really consolidated his power base. But as you say, it will all depend on the decisions that he takes both domestically, but also in relation to the Iran nuclear deal. So, I mean, if we could wrap up this conversation, it sounds as though we've got two new leaders in really important regional players in the Middle East, but we won't necessarily see a huge amount of political change. But thank you so much, Adam, for joining me, and thank you to our listeners. So next week, I'll be in the virtual armchair with Darlene, and Darlene will be discussing the future of the CDU, Angela Merkel's political party in Germany, and we'll be comparing what lies ahead for the CDU with the future of the UK Conservative Party, so another key centre-right political force in West. So I hope you'll join us for episode 4 of the Politics Podcast next week. But thank you so much for joining, and thank you, Adam, for those really insightful comments on Middle Eastern politics.
Yes, thank you for having me, Thomas. Take care.
We hope you enjoyed this Polis Podcast episode. At Polis Analysis, we are fully devoted to helping individuals better navigate the political world. So we would love to hear your thoughts, and please do share any suggestions you may have for future Polis Podcast episodes. Follow the Polis Podcast channel on Spotify to access our weekly episodes. And if you want to better navigate the political world with accessible, fact-based and impartial analysis of global politics, then sign up to our free newsletter at www.polisanalysis.com. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.